to century. Ray had no doubt that his father had chosen to die on the sofa so that the general could help him through it. The general knew. He knew how and when the judge died. He knew where the cash came from. He knew who had broken in last night and trashed the office. "Did he ever include Claudia in anything?" Ray asked.
"Never. He could hold a grudge, you know that."
"She stopped by this morning."
"What'd she want?"
"I think she was looking for money. She said the judge had always promised to take care of her, and she wanted to know what was in the will."
"Did you tell her?"
"With pleasure."
"She'll be all right. Never worry about that woman. You remember old Walter Sturgis out from Caraway, a dirt contractor for years, tight as a tick?"
Harry Rex knew everybody in the county, all 30,000 souls, blacks, whites, and now the Mexicans. "I don't think so."
"He's rumored to have $500,000 in cash, and she's after it. Got the old boy wearing golf shirts and eating at the country club. He told his buddies he takes Viagra every day."
"Attaboy.
She'll break him."
Forrest shifted somehow in the porch swing and the chains creaked. They waited a moment until all was quiet out there. Harry Rex opened a file and said,
"Here's the appraisal. We had it done late last year by a guy from Tupelo. Probably the best appraiser in North Mississippi."
"How much?"
$400,000.
"Sold."
"I thought he was high. Of course, the judge thought the place was worth $1 million.
"Of course."
"I figure $300,000 is more likely."
"We won't get half that much. What's the appraisal based on?"
"It's right here. Square footage, acreage, charm, comps, the usual."
"Give me a comp." Harry Rex flipped through the appraisal.
"Here's one. A house about the same age, same size, 30 acres, on the edge of Holly Springs, sold 2 years ago for $800,000.
"This is not Holly Springs."
"No, it's not.
That's an antebellum town with lots of old houses."
"You want me to sue the appraiser?"
"Yeah, let's go after him. What would you give for this place?"
"Nothing. You want a beer?"
"Nah." Harry Rex lumbered into the kitchen and returned with a tall can of Pabst Blue Ribbon.
"I don't know why he buys this stuff," he mumbled,
then gulped a fourth of it. Always been his brand. Harry Rex peeked through the blinds and saw nothing but Forrest's feet hanging off the swing.
"I don't think he's too worried about his father's estate."
"He's like Claudia, just wants a check."
"Money would kill him."
It was reassuring to hear Harry Rex share this belief. Ray waited until he returned to the desk because he wanted to watch his eyes carefully. "The judge earned less than $9,000 last year," Ray said, looking at a tax return.
"He was sick," Harry Rex said,
stretching and twisting his substantial back, then sitting down.
"But he was hearing cases until this year."
"What kind of cases?"
"All sorts of stuff. We had this Nazi right-wing governor a few years back."
"I remember him."
"Liked to pray all the time when he campaigned. Family values. Anti-everything but guns. Turned out he liked the ladies. His wife called him Big Stink. Really juicy stuff. The local judges down in Jackson wanted no part of the case for obvious reasons, so they asked the judge to ride in and referee things."
"Did it go to trial?"
"Oh, hell yeah. Big ugly trial. The wife had the goods on the governor who thought he could intimidate the judge. She got the governor's house and most of the money. Last I heard, he was living above his brother's garage. With bodyguards, of course."
"Did you ever see the old man intimidated?"
"Never. Not once in 30 years.
Harry Rex worked on his beer, and Ray looked at another tax return. Things were quiet, and when he heard Forrest snore again, Ray said, "I found some money, Harry Rex." His eyes conveyed nothing, no conspiracy, no surprise, no relief. They didn't blink, and they didn't stare. He waited, then finally shrugged and said,
"How much?"
"A box full." The questions would follow, and Ray had tried to predict them. Again Harry Rex waited, then another innocent shrug.
"Where?"
"Over there in that cabinet behind the sofa." It was cash in a box. Over $90,000. So far, he had not told a lie. He certainly hadn't given the entire truth, but he wasn't lying. Not yet.
$90,000?
Harry Rex said a little too loudly, and Ray nodded toward the porch. Yes, in $100 bills, he said in a lower voice. Any idea where it came from? Harry Rex gulped from the can, then squinted his eyes at the wall and finally said, Not really. Gambling? You said he could throw the dice. Another sip.
Yeah, maybe. The casinos opened 6 or 7 years ago, and he and I would go once a week, at least in the beginning.
You stopped?
I wish, between me and you, I was going all the time. I was gambling so much I didn't want the judge to know it. So whenever he and I went, I always played it light. Next night I'd sneak over and lose my ass again.
How much did you lose?
Let's talk about the judge.
Okay. Did he win?
Usually. On a good night, he'd win a couple thousand.
On a bad night?
500. That was his limit. If he was losing, he knew when to quit. That's the secret to gambling. You gotta know when to quit, and you gotta have the guts to walk away. He did. I did not.
Did he go without you?
Yeah, I saw him once. I sneaked over one night and picked a new casino. Hell, they got 15 now. And while I was playing blackjack, things got hot at a craps table not too far away. In the thick of things, I saw Judge Attlee. Had on a baseball cap so folks wouldn't recognize him. His disguises didn't always work because I'd hear things around town. A lot of folks go to the casinos, and there were sightings.
How often did he go?
Who knows? He answered to no one. I had a client, one of those Higginbotham boys who sell used cars, and he told me he saw old Judge Attlee at the craps table at 3 o'clock one morning at Treasure Island. So I figured the judge sneaked over at odd hours so folks wouldn't see him.
Ray did some quick math. If the judge gambled 3 times a week for 5 years and won $2,000 every time, his winnings would have been somewhere around $1.5 million. Could he have rat-holed $90,000, Ray asked. It sounded like such a small amount.
Anything is possible, but why hide it?
You tell me. They pondered this for a while. Harry Rex finished the beer and lit a cigar. A sluggish ceiling fan above the desk pushed the smoke around. He shot a cloud of exhaust toward the fan and said,
You gotta pay taxes on your winnings, and since he didn't want anybody to know about his gambling, maybe he just kept it all quiet.
But don't the casinos require paperwork if you win a certain amount?
I never saw any damn paperwork.
But if you'd won?
Yeah, they do. I had a client who won $11,000 at the $5 slots. They gave him a form 1099, a notice to the IRS.
What about shooting craps?
If you cash in more than $10,000 in chips at one time, then there's paperwork. Keep it under 10 and there's nothing. Same as cash transactions at a bank.
I doubt if the judge wanted records.
I'm sure he did not.
He never mentioned any cash when y'all were doing his wills.
Never. The money is a secret, Ray. I can't explain it. I have no idea what he was thinking. Surely he knew it would be found.
Right. The question now is, what do we do with it? Harry Rex nodded and stuck the cigar in his mouth. Ray leaned back and watched the fan. For a long time, they contemplated what to do with the money. Neither wanted to suggest that they simply continue to hide it. Harry Rex decided to fetch another beer. Ray said he'd take one, too. As the minutes passed, it became obvious that the money would not be discussed again. Not that day. In a few weeks, when the estate was opened and an inventory of assets was filled, they could visit the issue again. Or perhaps they would not. For 2 days, Ray had debated whether or not to tell Harry Rex about the cash. Not the entire fortune, but just a sample of it. After doing so, there were more questions than answers. Little light had been shed on the money. The judge enjoyed the dice and was good at gambling, but it seemed unlikely he could have cleared $3.1 million in 7 years. And to do so without creating paperwork and leaving a trail seemed impossible. Ray returned to the tax records while Harry Rex plowed through the ledgers of donations. Which CPA are you going to use? Ray asked after a long period of silence.
There are several.
Not local.
No. I stay away from the guys around here. It's a small town.
Looks to me like the records are in good shape, Ray said, closing a drawer.
It'll be easy, except for the house.
Let's put it on the market. The sooner the better. It won't be a quick sell.
What's the asking price?
Let's start at 300.
Are we spending money to fix it up?
There is no money, Harry Rex. Just before dark, Forrest announced that he was tired of Clanton, tired of death, tired of hanging around a depressing old house he had never particularly cared for, tired of Harry Rex and Ray, and that he was going home to Memphis, where wild women and parties were waiting.
When are you coming back? He asked Ray.
2 or 3 weeks.
For probate?
Yes, Harry Rex answered.
We'll make a brief appearance before the judge. You're welcome to be there, but it's not required.
I don't do court. Been there enough.
The brothers walked down the drive to Forrest's car.
You okay?
Ray asked, but only because he felt compelled to show concern.
I'm fine. See you, bro.
Forrest said in a hurry to leave before his brother blurted something stupid.
Call me when you come back, he said.
He started the car and drove away. Ray knew he would pull over somewhere between Clanton and Memphis, either at a joint with a bar and a pool table, or maybe just a beer store where he would buy a case and slug it as he drove. Forrest had survived his father's funeral in an impressive way, but the pressure had been building. The meltdown would not be pretty. Harry Rex was hungry as usual and asked if Ray wanted fried catfish.
Not really, he answered.
Good. There's a new place on the lake.
What's it called?
Jeter's Catfish Shack?
You're kidding.
No, it's delicious.
They dined on an empty deck jutting over a swamp on the backwaters of the lake. Harry Rex ate catfish twice a week, Ray once every 5 years. The cook was heavy on the batter and peanut oil, and Ray knew it would be a long night for several reasons. He slept with a loaded gun in the bed of his old room upstairs with the windows and doors locked, and the 3 garbage bags packed with money at his feet. With such an arrangement, it was difficult to look around in the dark and conjure up any pleasant childhood memories that would normally be just under the surface. The house had been dark and cold back then, especially after his mother died. Instead of reminiscing, he tried to sleep by counting little round black chips, $100 each, hauled by the judge from the tables to the cashiers. He counted with imagination and ambition, and he got nowhere near the fortune he was in bed with. Chapter 14. The Clanton Square had 3 cafes, 2 for the whites and 1 for the blacks. The tea shop crowd leaned toward banking and law and retail, more of a white-collar bunch, where the chatter was a bit heavier. The stock market, politics, golf. Claude's, the black diner, had been around for 40 years and had the best food. The coffee shop was favored by the farmers, cops, and factory workers who talked football and bird hunting. Harry Rex preferred it, as did a few other lawyers who liked to eat with the people they represented. It opened at 5 every morning but Sunday, and was usually crowded by 6. Ray parked near it on the square and locked his car. The sun was inching above the hills to the east. He would drive 15 hours or so, and hopefully be home by midnight. Harry Rex had a table in the window, and a Jackson newspaper that had already been rearranged and folded to the point of being useless to anyone else.
"Anything in the news?" Ray asked.
There was no television at Maple Run.
"Not a damn thing," Harry Rex grumbled with his eyes glued to the editorials. "I'll send you all the obituaries."
He slid across a crumpled section the size of a paperback.
"You want to read this?"
"No, I need to go."
"You eating first?"
"Yes."
"Hey, Dale?"
Harry Rex yelled across the cafe. The counter and booths and other tables were crowded with men. Only men. All eating and talking.
"Dale is still here?" Ray asked.
"She doesn't age," Harry Rex said, waving. "Her mother's 80 and her grandmother is 100. She'll be here long after we're buried."
Dale did not appreciate being yelled at. She arrived with a coffee pot and an attitude, which vanished when she realized who Ray was. She hugged him and said,
"I haven't seen you in 20 years.
Then she sat down, clutched his arm, and began saying how sorry she was about the judge.
"Wasn't it a great funeral?" Harry Rex said.
"I can't remember a finer one," she said,
as if Ray was supposed to be both comforted and impressed. "Thank you," he said, his eyes watering not from sadness, but from the medley of cheap perfume swirling about her. Then she jumped up and said, "What are y'all eating? It's on the house." Harry Rex decided on pancakes and sausage for both of them. Tall stack for him, short for Ray. Dell disappeared, a thick cloud of fragrances lingering behind.
"You got a long drive. Pancakes'll stick to your ribs."
After 3 days in Clanton, everything was sticking to his ribs. Ray looked forward to some long runs in the countryside around Charlottesville and to much lighter cuisine. To his great relief, nobody else recognized him. There were no other lawyers in the coffee shop at that hour, and no one else who'd known the judge well enough to attend his funeral. The cops and mechanics were too busy with their jokes and gossip to look around. Remarkably, Dell kept her mouth shut. After the first cup of coffee, Ray relaxed and began to enjoy the waves of conversation and laughter around him. Dell was back with enough food for 8. Pancakes, a whole hog's worth of sausage, a tray of hefty biscuits with a bowl of butter, and a bowl of somebody's homemade jam. Why would anyone need biscuits to eat with pancakes? She patted his shoulder again and said,
"And he was such a sweet man."
Then she was gone.
"Your father was a lot of things," Harry Rex said, drowning his hotcakes with at least a quart of somebody's homemade molasses. "But he wasn't sweet."
"No, he was not," Ray agreed. "Did he ever come in here?"
"Not that I recall. He didn't eat breakfast, didn't like crowds, hated small talk, preferred to sleep as late as possible. I don't think this was his kind of place. For the past 9 years, he hadn't been seen much around the square."
"Where'd she meet him?"
"In court. One of her daughters had a baby. The daddy already had a family, a real mess."
He somehow managed to shovel into his mouth a serving of pancakes that would choke a horse, then a bite of sausage. "And of course you were in the middle of it."
"Of course. Judge treated her right.
Chomp, chomp." Ray felt compelled to take a large bite of his food. With molasses dripping everywhere, he leaned forward and lifted a heavy fork to his mouth.
"The judge was a legend, Ray. You know that. Folks around here loved him. He never got less than 80% of the vote in Ford County."
Ray nodded as he worked on the pancakes. They were hot and buttery, but not particularly tasty.
"If we spend $5,000 on the house," Harry Rex said, without showing food, "then we'll get it back several times over. It's a good investment."
"$5,000 for what?" He wiped his mouth with one long swipe.
"Clean the damn thing first. Spray it, wash it, fumigate it. Clean the floors and walls and furniture. Make it smell better. Then paint the outside and the downstairs. Fix the roof so the ceilings won't spot. Cut the grass, pull the weeds, just spruce it up. I can find folks around here to do it."
He thrust another serving into his jaws and waited for Ray to respond. "There's only $6,000 in the bank," Ray said. Dell dashed by and somehow managed to refill both coffee cups and pat Ray on the shoulder without missing a stride.
"You got more in that box you found," Harry Rex said, carving another wedge of pancakes.
"So we spend it?"
"I've been thinking about it," he said, gulping coffee. "Fact, I was up all night thinking about it."
"And?"
"Got 2 issues. One's important, the other's not."
A quick bite of modest proportions, then using the knife and fork to help him talk, he continued.
"First, where'd it come from? That's what we want to know, but it ain't really that important. If he robbed a bank, he's dead. If he hit the casinos and didn't pay taxes, he's dead. If he simply liked the smell of cash and saved it over the years, he's still dead. You follow?"
Ray shrugged as if he was waiting for something complicated. Harry Rex used the break in his monologue to eat sausage, then began stabbing the air again.
"Second, what are you going to do with it? That's what's important. We're assuming nobody knows about the money, right?"
Ray nodded and said, "Right, it was hidden." Ray could hear the windows being rattled. He could see the Blake and Sons boxes scattered and crushed. He couldn't help but glance through the window and look at his TT Roadster, packed and ready to flee.
"If you include the money in the estate, half will go to the IRS.
"I know that, Harry Rex. What would you do?"
"I'm not the right person to ask. I've been at war with the IRS for 18 years, and guess who's winning? Not me. Screw 'em."
"That's your advice as an attorney?"
"No, as a friend.
If you want legal advice, then I will tell you that all assets must be collected and properly inventoried pursuant to the Mississippi Code as annotated and amended. Thank you. I'd take $20,000 or so, put it in the estate to pay the upfront bills, then wait a long time and give Forrest his half of the rest.
Now that's what I call legal advice.
Nope, it's just common sense.
The mystery of the biscuits was solved when Harry Rex attacked them.
How about a biscuit?
He said, though they were closer to Ray. No thanks. Harry Rex sliced two in half, buttered them, added a thick layer of jam, then at the last moment inserted a patty of sausage.
You sure?
Yes, I'm sure.
Could the money be marked in any way? Only if it's ransom or drug money. Don't reckon Reuben Attlee was into those sorts of things, you?
Okay. Spend $5,000.
You'll be pleased.
A small man with matching khaki pants and shirt stopped at the table and with a warm smile said, "Excuse me, Ray, but I'm Lloyd Darling." He stuck out a hand as he spoke. "I have a farm just east of town." Ray shook his hand and half stood. Mr. Lloyd Darling owned more land than anybody in Ford County. He had once taught Ray in Sunday school.
"So good to see you," Ray said.
"Keep your seat," he said, gently shoving Ray down by the shoulder. "Just wanted to say how sorry I am about the judge."
"Thank you, Mr. Darling."
"There was no finer man than Reuben Attlee. You have my sympathies."
Ray just nodded. Harry Rex had stopped eating and appeared to be ready to cry. Then Lloyd was gone, and breakfast resumed.
Harry Rex launched into a war story about IRS abuse. After another bite or two, Ray was stuffed, and as he pretended to listen, he thought of all the fine folks who so greatly admired his father, all the Lloyd Darlings out there who revered the old man. What if the cash didn't come from the casinos? What if a crime had been committed, some secret, horrible sting perpetrated by the judge? Sitting there among the crowd in the coffee shop, watching Harry Rex but not listening to him, Ray Attlee made a decision. He vowed to himself that if he ever discovered that the cash now crammed into the trunk of his car had been collected by his father in some manner that was less than ethical, then no one would ever know it. He would not desecrate the stellar reputation of Judge Reuben Attlee. He signed a contract with himself, shook hands, made a blood oath, swore to God. Never would anyone know. They said goodbye on the sidewalk in front of yet another law office. Harry Rex bear-hugged him, and Ray tried to return the embrace, but his arms were pinned to his sides.
"I can't believe he's gone," Harry Rex said, his eyes moist again.
"I know. I know." He walked away, shaking his head and fighting back tears. Ray jumped in his Audi and left the square without looking back. Minutes later, he was on the edge of town, past the old drive-in where porno had been introduced, past the shoe factory where a strike had been mediated by the judge. Past everything until he was in the country, away from the traffic, away from the legend. He glanced at his speedometer and realized he was driving almost 90 miles an hour. Cops should be avoided, as well as rear-end collisions. The drive was long, but the timing of the arrival in Charlottesville was crucial. Too early, and there would be foot traffic on the downtown mall. Too late, and the night patrol might see him and ask questions. Across the Tennessee line, he stopped for gas and a restroom break. He had had too much coffee and too much food. He tried to call Forrest on his cell phone, but there was no answer. He took it as neither good news or bad. With Forrest, nothing was predictable. Moving again, he kept his speed at 55, and the hours began to pass. Ford County faded into another lifetime. Everyone has to be from somewhere, and Clanton was not a bad place to call home. But if he never saw it again, he would not be unhappy. Exams were over in a week, then summer break. Because he was supposed to be researching and writing, he had no classes to teach for the next 3 months, which meant he had very little to do at all. He would return to Clanton and take the oath as executor of his father's estate. He would make all the decisions that Harry Rex asked him to make, and he would try to solve the mystery of the money. Chapter 15. With ample time to plan his movements, he was not surprised when nothing went right. His arrival time was suitable, 11:20 p.m., Wednesday, May 10th. He had hoped to park illegally on the curb, just a few feet from the ground-level door to his apartment, but other drivers had the same idea. The curb had never been so completely blocked with a line of cars, and to his anxious satisfaction, every one of them had a citation under a windshield wiper. He could park in the street while he dashed back and forth, but that would invite trouble. The small lot behind his building had four spaces, one reserved for him, but they locked the gate at 11. So he was forced to use a dark and almost completely abandoned parking garage three blocks away, a large cavernous multi-level that was sold out during the day and eerily empty at night. He had thought about this alternative off and on for many hours as he drove north and east and plotted the offensive, and it was the least attractive of all options. It was Plan D or E, somewhere way down the list of ways he wanted to transfer the money. He parked on level one, got out with his overnight bag, locked the car, and with great anxiety left it there. He hurried away, eyes darting around as if armed gangs were watching and waiting. His legs and back were stiff from the drive, but he had work to do. The apartment looked precisely the same as when he had left it, which was an odd relief. 34 messages awaited him, no doubt colleagues and friends calling with their sympathies. He would listen later. At the bottom of a tiny closet in the hall, under a blanket and a poncho and other things that had been tossed in as opposed to being placed or stored, he found a red Wimbledon tennis bag that he hadn't touched in at least 2 years. Other than luggage, which he thought would appear too suspicious, it was the largest bag he could think of. If he'd had a gun, he would have stuck it in his pocket. But crime was rare in Charlottesville, and he preferred to live without weapons. After the episode Sunday in Clanton, he was even more terrified of pistols and such. He had left the judge's guns hidden in a closet at Maple Run. With the bag slung over his shoulder, he locked his door on the street and tried his best to walk casually along the downtown mall. It was well lit, there was a cop or two always watching, and the pedestrians at this hour were the wayward kids with green hair, an occasional wino, and a few stragglers working their way home. Charlottesville was a quiet town after midnight. A thundershower had passed through not long before his arrival. The streets were wet, and the wind was blowing. He passed a young couple walking hand in hand, but saw no one else on the way to the garage. He had given some thought to simply hauling the garbage bags themselves, just throwing them over his shoulder like Santa, one at a time, and walking hurriedly from wherever he was parked to his apartment. He could move the money in three trips and cut his exposure on the street. Two things stopped him. First, what if one ripped and $1 million hit the pavement? Every thug and wino in town would come out of the alleys, drawn like sharks to blood. Second, the sight of anyone hauling bags of what appeared to be trash into an apartment, as opposed to away from it, might be suspicious enough to attract the attention of the police. "What's in the bag, sir?" a cop might ask. "Nothing. Garbage. $1 million? No answer seemed correct. So the plan was to be patient, take all the time that was necessary, move the loot in small loads, and not worry about how many trips might be required, because the least important factor was Ray's fatigue. He could rest later. The terrifying part was the transferring of the money from one bag to another while crouching over his trunk and trying not to look guilty. Fortunately, the garage was deserted. He crammed money into the tennis bag until it would barely zip, then slammed the trunk down, looked around as if he'd just smothered someone, and left. Perhaps a third of a garbage bag, $300,000. Much more than enough to get him arrested or knifed. Nonchalance was what he desperately wanted, but there was nothing fluid about his steps and movements. Eyes straight ahead, though the eyes wanted to dart up and down, right and left, nothing could be missed. A frightening teenager with studs in his nose stumbled by, stoned out of his wasted mind. Ray walked even faster, not sure if he had the nerves for 8 or 9 more trips to the parking garage. A drunk on a dark bench yelled something indecipherable at him. He lurched forward, then caught himself, and was thankful he had no gun. At that moment, he might have shot anything that moved. The cash got heavier with each block, but he made it without incident. He spilled the money onto his bed, locked every door possible, and took another route back to his car. During the fifth trip, he was confronted by a deranged old man who jumped from the shadows and demanded, "What the hell are you doing?" He was holding something dark in his hand. Ray assumed it was a weapon with which to slaughter him. "Get out of the way," he said as rudely as possible, but his mouth was dry.
"You keep going back and forth," the old man yelled.
He stank and his eyes were glowing like a demon. "Mind your own business." Ray had never stopped walking, and the old man was in front of him, bouncing along, the village idiot. "What's the problem?" came a clear, crisp voice from behind them. Ray stopped and a policeman ambled over, nightstick in hand. Ray was all smiles. "Evening, officer." He was breathing hard and his face was sweaty.
"He's up to something," the old man yelled. "Keeps going back and forth, back and forth. Goes that way, the bag is empty. Goes that way, the bag is full."
"Relax, Gilly," the cop said, and Ray took a deeper breath. He was horrified that someone had been watching, but relieved because that someone was of Gilly's ilk. Of all the characters on the mall, Ray had never seen this one. "What's in the bag?" the cop asked. It was a dumb question, far into foul territory, and for a split second, Ray, the law professor, considered a lecture on stops, searches, seizures, and permissible police questioning. He let it pass, though, and smoothly delivered the prepared line. "I played tennis tonight at Boar's Head. Got a bad hamstring, so I'm just walking it off. I live over there." He pointed to his apartment 2 blocks down. The cop turned to Gilly and said, "You can't be yelling at people, Gilly. I've told you that. Does Ted know you're out?"
"He's got something in that bag,"
Gilly said, much softer. The cop was leading him away. "Yeah, it's cash," said the cop. "I'm sure the guy's a bank robber, and you caught him. Good work."
"But it's empty, then it's full."
"Good night, sir," the officer said over his shoulder. "Good night." And Ray, the wounded tennis player, actually limped for half a block for the benefit of other characters lurking in the darkness. When he dumped the fifth load on his bed, he found a bottle of scotch in his small liquor cabinet and poured a stiff one. He waited for 2 hours, ample time for Gilly to return to Ted, who hopefully could keep him medicated and confined for the rest of the night, and time perhaps for a shift change so a different cop would be walking the beat. 2 very long hours, in which he imagined every possible scenario involving his car in the parking garage. Theft, vandalism, fire, towed away by some misguided wrecker, everything imaginable. At 3 a.m., he emerged from his apartment wearing jeans, hiking boots, and a navy sweatshirt with Virginia across the chest. He had ditched the red tennis bag in favor of a battered leather briefcase, one that would not hold as much money, but wouldn't catch the attention of the cop either. He was armed with a steak knife stuck in his belt under the sweatshirt, ready to be withdrawn in a flash and used on the likes of Gilly or any other assailant. It was foolish and he knew it, but he wasn't himself either, and he was quite aware of that. He was dead tired, sleep-deprived for the third night in a row, just a little tipsy from 3 scotches, determined to get the money safely hidden, and scared of getting stopped again. Even the winos had given up at 3 in the morning. The downtown streets were deserted, but as he entered the parking garage, he saw something that terrified him. At the far end of the mall, passing under a street lamp, was a group of 5 or 6 black teenagers. They were moving slowly in his general direction, yelling, talking loudly, looking for trouble. It would be impossible to make a half dozen more deliveries without running into them. The final plan was created on the spot. Ray cranked the Audi and left the garage. He circled around and stopped in the street, next to the cars parked illegally on the curb, close to the door to his apartment. He killed the engine and the lights, opened the trunk, and grabbed the money. 5 minutes later, the entire fortune was upstairs where it belonged. At 9 a.m., the phone woke him. It was Harry Rex.
"Wake your ass up, boy," he growled. "How was the trip?"
Ray swung to the edge of his bed and tried to open his eyes.
"Wonderful," he grunted.
"I talked to a realtor yesterday, Baxter Redd, one of the better ones in town. We walked around the place, kicked the tires, you know. What a mess. Anyway, he wants to stick to the appraised value, $400,000, and he thinks we can get at least $250,000. He gets the usual 6%. You there?"
"Yeah."
"Then say something, okay?"
"Keep going."
"He agrees we need to spend some dough to fix it up. A little paint, a little floor wax, a good bonfire would help. He recommended a cleaning service."
"You there?"
"Yes."
Harry Rex had been up for hours, no doubt refueled with another feast of pancakes, biscuits, and sausage.
"Anyway, I've already hired a painter and a roofer. We'll need an infusion of capital pretty soon."
"I'll be back in 2 weeks, Harry Rex. Can it wait?"
"Sure." "You hungover?"
"No, just tired."
"Well, get your ass in gear. It's after 9 there."
"Thanks."
"Speaking of hangovers," he said, his voice suddenly lower, his words softer. "Forrest called me last night."
Ray stood and arched his back.
"This can't be good," he said.
"No, it's not."
"He's tanked. Couldn't tell if it was booze or drugs, probably both. Whatever he's on, there's plenty of it. He was so mellow I thought he was falling asleep. Then he'd fire up and cuss me."
"What did he want?"
"Money. Not now, he says. Claims he's not broke. But he's concerned about the house and the estate and wants to make sure you don't screw him."
"Screw him?"
"He was bomb, Ray, so you can't hold it against him. But he said some pretty bad things."
"I'm listening."
"I'm telling you so you'll know, but please don't get upset. I doubt he'll remember it this morning."
"Go ahead, Harry Rex."
"He said the judge always favored you, and that's why he made you the executor of his estate, that you've always gotten more out of the old man, that it's my job to watch you and protect his interests in the estate, because you'll try to screw him out of the money, and so on."
"That didn't take long, did it? We've hardly got him in the ground."
"No, I'm not surprised. Keep your guard up. He's on a binge, and he might call you with the same crap."
"I've heard it before, Harry Rex. His problems are not his fault. Somebody's always out to get him.
Typical addict. He thinks the house is worth $1 million and said it's my job to get that much for it. Otherwise, he might have to hire his own lawyer, blah, blah, blah. It didn't bother me. Again, he was blitzed."
"He's pitiful."
"He is indeed, but he'll bottom out and sober up in a week or so. Then I'll cuss him. We'll be fine."
"Sorry, Harry Rex."
"It's part of my job. Just one of the joys of practicing law."
Ray fixed a pot of coffee, a strong Italian blend he was quite attached to, and had missed sorely in Clanton. The first cup was almost gone before his brain woke up. Any trouble with Forrest would run its course. In spite of his many problems, he was basically harmless. Harry Rex would handle the estate, and there would be an equal division of everything left over. In a year or so, Forrest would get a check for more money than he had ever seen. The image of a cleaning service turned loose at Maple Run bothered him for a while. He could see a dozen women buzzing around like ants, happy with so much to clean. What if they stumbled upon another treasure trove, fiendishly left behind by the judge? Mattresses stuffed with cash, closets filled with loot. But it wasn't possible. Ray had pored over every inch of the house. "You find $3 million tucked away, and you get motivated to pry under every board." He had even clawed his way through spider webs in the basement, a dungeon no cleaning lady would enter. He poured another cup of strong coffee and walked to his bedroom, where he sat in a chair and stared at the piles of cash. Now what? Through the blur of the last 4 days, he had concentrated only on getting the money to the spot where it was now located. Now he had to plan the next step, and he had very few ideas. It had to be hidden and protected. He knew that much for sure.
Chapter 16.
There was a large floral arrangement in the center of his desk, with a sympathy card signed by all 14 students in his antitrust class. Each had written a small paragraph of condolences, and he read them all. Beside the flowers was a stack of cards from his colleagues on the faculty. Word spread fast that he was back, and throughout the morning the same colleagues dropped by with a quick hello, welcome back, sorry about your loss. For the most part, the faculty was a close group. They could bicker with the best of them on the trivial issues of campus politics, but they were quick to circle the wagons in times of need. Ray was very happy to see them. Alex Duffman's wife sent a platter of her infamous chocolate brownies, each weighing a pound and proven to add 3 more to your waist. Naomi Craig brought a small collection of roses she'd picked from her garden. Late in the morning, Carl Merck stopped by and closed the door. Ray's closest friend on the faculty, his journey to the law school had been remarkably similar. They were the same age, and both had fathers who were small-town judges who had ruled their little counties for decades. Carl's father was still on the bench and still holding a grudge because his son did not return to practice law in the family firm. It appeared, though, that the grudge was fading with the years, whereas Judge Attlee apparently carried his to his death. "Tell me about it," Carl said. Before long, he would make the same trip back to his hometown in northern Ohio. Ray began with the peaceful house, too peaceful, he recalled now. He described the scene when he found the judge. "You found him dead?" Carl asked. The narrative continued. Then, "You think he speeded things up a bit?" "I hope so. He was in a lot of pain." "Wow." The story unfolded in great detail as Ray remembered things he had not thought about since last Sunday. The words poured forth. The telling became therapeutic. Carl was an excellent listener. Forrest and Harry Rex were colorfully described. "We don't have characters like that in Ohio," Carl said. When they told their small-town stories, usually to colleagues from the cities, they stretched the facts and the characters became larger. Not so with Forrest and Harry Rex. The truth was sufficiently colorful. The wake, the funeral, the burial. When Ray closed with taps and the lowering of the casket, both had moist eyes. Carl bounced to his feet and said, "What a great way to go. I'm sorry. Just glad it's over. Welcome back. Let's do lunch tomorrow." "What's tomorrow?" "Friday. Lunch it is." For his noon antitrust class, Ray ordered pizzas from a carryout and ate them outside in the courtyard with his students. 13 of the 14 were there. 8 would be graduating in 2 weeks. The students were more concerned about Ray and the death of his father than about their final exams. He knew that would change quickly. When the pizza was gone, he dismissed them and they scattered. Kaylee lingered behind, as she had been doing in the past months. There was a rigid no-fly zone between faculty and students, and Ray Attlee was not about to venture into it. He was much too content with his job to risk it fooling around with a student. In 2 weeks, though, Kaylee would no longer be a student, but a graduate, and thus not covered by the rules. The flirting had picked up a bit. A serious question after class, a drop-in at his office to get a missed assignment, and always that smile with the eyes that lingered for just a second too long. She was an average student with a lovely face and a rear end that stopped traffic. She had played field hockey and lacrosse at Brown and kept a lean, athletic figure. She was 28, a widow with no kids, and loads of money she'd received from the company that made the glider her deceased husband had been flying when it cracked up a few miles off the coast at Cape Cod. They found him in 60 feet of water, still strapped in, both wings snapped in two. Ray had researched the accident report online. He had also found the court file in Rhode Island where she had sued. The settlement gave her $4 million up front and $500,000 a year for the next 20 years. He had kept this information to himself. After chasing the boys for the first 2 years of law school, she was now chasing the men. Ray knew of at least 2 other law professors who were getting the same lingering routine as he. One just happened to be married. Evidently, all were as wary as Ray. They strolled into the front entrance of the law school, chatting aimlessly about the final exam. She was easing closer with each flirtation, warming up to the zone, the only one who knew where she might be headed with this. "I'd like to go flying sometime," she announced. Anything but flying. Ray thought of her young husband and his horrible death, and for a second could think of nothing to say. Finally, with a smile, he said, "Buy a ticket."
"No. No, with you in a small plane. Let's fly somewhere."
"Any place in particular?"
"Just buzz around for a while. I'm thinking of taking lessons."
"I was thinking of something more traditional. Maybe lunch or dinner after you graduate." She had stepped closer, so that anyone who walked by at that moment would have no doubt that they, student and professor, were discussing illicit activity.
"I graduate in 14 days, she said, as if she might not be able to wait that long before they hopped in the sack.
"Then I'll ask you to dinner in 15 days.
"No, let's break the rule now, while I'm still a student. Let's have dinner before I graduate."
He almost said yes. "Afraid not. The law is the law. We're here because we respect it."
"Oh, yes. It's so easy to forget. But we have a date?"
"No, we will have a date." She flashed another smile and walked away. He tried mightily not to admire her exit, but it was impossible. The rented van came from a moving company north of town, $60 a day. He tried for a half-day rate because he would need it only for a few hours, but 60 it was. He drove it exactly 0.4 miles and stopped at Cheney's Self-Storage, a sprawling arrangement of new cinderblock rectangles surrounded by chain link and shiny new razor wire. Video cameras on light poles watched his every move as he parked and walked into the office. Plenty of space was available. A 10x10 bay was $48 a month, no heating, no air, a roll-down door, and plenty of lighting. "Is it fireproof?" Ray asked.
"Absolutely,"
said Mrs. Cheney herself, fighting off the smoke from the cigarette stuck between her lips as she filled in forms.
"Nothing but concrete block."
Everything was safe at Cheney's. They featured electronic surveillance, she explained, as she waved at 4 monitors on a shelf to her left. On a shelf to her right was a small television wherein folks were yelling and fighting, a Springer-style gabfest that was now a brawl. Ray knew which shelf received the most attention.
24-hour guard," she said, still doing the paperwork. "Gates locked at all times. Never had a break-in, and if one happens, then we got all kinds of insurance. Sign right here. 14B.
"Insurance on $3 million, Ray said to himself as he scribbled his name. He paid cash for 6 months and took the keys to 14B. He was back 2 hours later with 6 new storage boxes, a pile of old clothes, and a stick or two of worthless furniture he had picked up at a flea market downtown for authenticity. He parked in the alley in front of 14B and worked quickly to unload and store his junk. The cash was stuffed into 42-ounce freezer bags, zipped tight to keep air and water out, 53 in all. The freezer bags were arranged in the bottoms of the 6 storage boxes, then carefully covered with papers and files and research notes that Ray had until very recently deemed useful. Now his meticulous files served a much higher calling. A few old paperbacks were thrown in for good measure. If by chance a thief penetrated 14B, he would probably abandon it after a cursory look into the boxes. The money was well hidden and as well protected as possible. Short of a safety deposit box in a bank, Ray could think of no better place to secure the money. What would ultimately become of the money was a mystery that grew by the day. The fact that it was now safely tucked away in Virginia provided little comfort, contrary to what he had hoped. He watched the boxes and the other junk for a while, not really anxious to leave. He vowed to himself that he would not stop by every day to check on things, but as soon as the vow was made, he began to doubt it. He secured the roll-down door with a new padlock. As he drove away, the guard was awake, the video camera scanning, the gate locked. Fog Newton was worrying about the weather. He had a student pilot on a cross-country to Lynchburg and back, and thunderstorms were moving in quickly, according to radar. The clouds had not been expected, and no weather had been forecast during the student's pre-flight briefing. "How many hours does he have?" Ray asked.
31, Fogg said gravely.
Certainly not enough experience to handle thunderstorms. There were no airports between Charlottesville and Lynchburg, only mountains.
"You're not flying, are you?"
Fogg asked.
"I want to." "Forget it. This storm is coming together quickly. Let's go watch it."
Nothing frightened an instructor more than a student up in heavy weather. Each cross-country training flight had to be carefully planned. Route, time, fuel, weather, secondary airports, and emergency procedures. And each flight had to be approved in writing by the instructor. Fogg had once grounded Ray because there was a slight chance of icing at 5,000 feet on a perfectly clear day. They walked through the hangar to the ramp where a Lear was parking and shutting down its engines. To the west beyond the foothills was the first hint of clouds. The wind had picked up noticeably.
10 to 15 knots gusting, Fogg said. A direct crosswind.
Ray would not want to attempt a landing in such conditions. Behind the Lear was a Bonanza taxiing to the ramp, and as it got closer, Ray noticed that it was the one he'd been coveting for the past 2 months.
"There's your plane," Fogg said.
"I wish," Ray said. The Bonanza parked and shut down near them, and when the ramp was quiet again, Fogg said,
"I hear he's cut the price."
"How much?"
"Somewhere around $425. $450 was a little steep."
The owner, traveling alone, crawled out and pulled his bags from the rear. Fogg was gazing at the sky and glancing at his watch. Ray kept his eyes on the Bonanza, where the owner was locking the door and putting it to rest. "Let's take it for a spin," Ray said.
"The Bonanza?"
"Sure. What's the rent?"
"It's negotiable. I know the guy pretty well."
"Let's get it for a day. Fly up to Atlantic City, then back." Fogg forgot about the approaching clouds and the rookie student. He turned and looked at Ray.
"You serious?"
"Why not? Sounds like fun." Aside from flying and poker, Fogg had few other interests.
"When?"
"Saturday. Day after tomorrow. Leave early, come back late." Fogg was suddenly deep in thought. He glanced at his watch, looked once more to the west, then to the south. Dick Docker yelled from a window, "Yankee Tango is 10 miles out."
"Thank God,"
Fogg mumbled to himself and visibly relaxed. He and Ray walked to the Bonanza for a closer look.
"Saturday, huh?" Fogg said.
"Yep, all day."
"I'll catch the owner. I'm sure we can work a deal."
The winds relented for a moment, and Yankee Tango landed with little effort. Fogg relaxed even more and managed to smile.
"Didn't know you liked the action," he said as they walked across the ramp.
"Just a little blackjack. Nothing serious," Ray said.
Chapter 17 The solitude of a late Friday morning was broken by the doorbell. Ray had slept late, still trying to shake off the fatigue from the trip home. 3 newspapers and 4 coffees later, he was almost fully awake. It was a FedEx box from Harry Rex, and it was filled with letters from admirers and newspaper clippings. Ray spread them on the dining table and began with the articles. The Clanton Chronicle ran a front-page piece on Wednesday that featured a dignified photo of Reuben Attlee, complete with black robe and gavel. The picture was at least 20 years old. The judge's hair was thicker and darker, and he filled out the robe. The headline read, "Judge Reuben Attlee Dead at 79. There were 3 stories on the front page. One was a flowery obituary. One was a collection of comments from his friends. The third was a tribute to the judge and his amazing gift of charity. The Ford County Times likewise had a picture, one taken just a few years earlier. In it, Judge Attlee was sitting on the front porch holding his pipe, looking much older, but offering a rare smile. He wore a cardigan and looked like a grandfather. The reporter had cajoled him into a feature with the ruse of chatting about the Civil War and Nathan Bedford Forrest. There was the hint of a book in the works, one about the general and the men from Ford County who had fought with him. The Attlee sons were barely mentioned in the stories about their father. Referring to one would require referring to the other, and most folks in Clanton wanted to avoid the subject of Forrest. It was painfully obvious that the sons were not a part of their father's life. But we could have been, Ray said to himself. It was the father who'd chosen early on to have limited involvement with the sons, not the other way around. This wonderful old man who'd given so much to so many had had so little time for his own family. The stories and photos made him sad, which was frustrating, because he had not planned to be sad this Friday. He had held up quite well since discovering his father's body 5 days earlier. In moments of grief and sorrow, he had dug deep and found the strength to bite his lip and push forward without breaking down. The passage of time and the distance to Clanton had helped immensely, and now from nowhere had come the saddest reminders yet. The letters had been collected by Harry Rex from the judge's post office box in Clanton, from the courthouse, and from the mailbox at Maple Run. Some were addressed to Ray and Forrest, and some to the family of Judge Attlee. There were lengthy letters from lawyers who'd practiced before the great man and had been inspired by his passion for the law. There were cards of sympathy from people who, for one reason or another, had appeared before Judge Attlee in a divorce or adoption or juvenile matter, and his fairness had changed their lives. There were notes from people all over the state, sitting judges, old law school pals, politicians Judge Attlee had helped over the years, and friends who wanted to pass along their sympathies and fond memories. The largest batch came from those who had received the judge's charity. The letters were long and heartfelt, and all the same. Judge Attlee had quietly sent money that was desperately needed, and in many cases it had made a dramatic change in the life of someone. How could a man so generous die with more than $3 million hidden below his bookshelves? He certainly buried more than he gave away. Perhaps Alzheimer's had crept into his life, or some other affliction that had gone undetected. Had he slipped toward insanity? The easy answer was that the old man had simply gone nuts. But how many crazy people could put together that kind of money? After reading 20 or so letters and cards, Ray took a break. He walked to the small balcony overlooking the downtown mall and watched the pedestrians below. His father had never seen Charlottesville, and though Ray was certain he had asked him to visit, he could not remember a specific invitation. They had never traveled anywhere together. There were so many things they could have done. The judge had always talked of seeing Gettysburg, Antietam, Bull Run, Chancellorsville, and Appomattox, and he would have done so had Ray shown an interest. But Ray cared nothing for the refighting of an old war, and he had always changed the subject. The guilt hit hard, and he couldn't shake it. What a selfish ass he'd been. There was a lovely card from Claudia. She thanked Ray for talking to her and expressing his forgiveness. She had loved his father for years and would carry her grief to her grave. "Please call me," she begged, then signed off with hugs and kisses. And she's got her current boyfriend on Viagra, according to Harry Rex. The nostalgic journey home came to an abrupt halt with a simple, anonymous card that froze his pulse and sent goosebumps down the backs of both legs. The only pink envelope in the pile contained a card with the words, "With sympathy," on the outside. Taped to the inside was a small square piece of paper.